Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Do you ever worry that your job might be obsolete one day? If so, that's probably because of automation, right? So what can you do, or what can your industry do to deal with that? Darren Gresh is with the Conference Board of Canada. He's here to talk about the path forward. Relationships and money, complicated, always complicated. But what about for teenagers? I'd never even thought of this before. Ed Grahalski is with Junior Achievement. He's going to bring us the findings from its latest study that looks at the kind of power dynamics can exist even for teenagers and what parents can do to watch out for that dynamic. Now, maybe all teens should just go and participate in this program for Momentum. It is called the Youth Fair Gains Program. It is very simple. It teaches stuff. It also has a match savings program, so participants get to learn and earn. Carolyn Davis from Momentum will be here. Then Christine Beese from Untangle Money tells us how she's trying to address some of the barriers that that women face when it comes to getting a handle on their money and making investments in private equity accessible for everyone. We'll speak with the CEO of Stack Capital, Jeff Parks. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Machines are going to take your job. That has been the fear. That has been the fear pretty much since the Industrial Revolution began. And in some parts of the economy, it's not an inaccurate or far-flung fear, right? Innovations like steam power and the assembly line and more recently artificial intelligence have genuinely affected the job market and in some cases dramatically. So what's next? Are they coming after me too? Will a bot host this radio show? I don't know. Maybe it's not that hard. Joining me now to talk about automation and how it could affect you is Darren Gresh, Senior Research Associate of Innovation and Tech at the Conference Board of Canada. He joins me from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Can a bot replace me? Seriously, is this coming? Should I prepare myself?
You know, you've brought up something that has been like a topic that we've tried to address and emphasize in how we talk about automation. So
how to get Bruce Celery off the air.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So at its core, automation is about reducing human intervention. But if you look at it from a simple level, say you're gardening and you don't have any tools and you have to dig in the dirt with your hands. You introduce a spade or a hoe and you're no longer having to move that dirt yourself, but indirectly, and you're able to do a better job. You're able to be more efficient with your effort and allow you to increase the total value of what you're getting out of it. If you move a little bit further down that technological chain, maybe you've hitched a plow to the back of an animal where, you know, no longer are you tilling the dirt yourself, but maybe you're making sure that the plow stays on course, doesn't get caught up in any obstacles, and you're ensuring that the animals have what they need and that they're doing what's expected of them. Take it a little bit further. You know, you have a large modern tractor where, yes, you need someone to drive and operate the tractor, and maybe you're able to do a lot more value-added tasks with it, right? Maybe it's not just tilling a field, but you're able to fertilize and
plant then by seeds. 2030, it's a drone. I've seen these drone tree planting devices, and they're amazing.
Yeah. So, they're just going to actually 3D print your food. So.
Right. There you go. That's the end point. 3D printing my food. So which occupations are at the highest risk right now?
Yeah. So that's it's an interesting question, because if you look at it from a pure automation perspective, there's some characteristics like the types of tasks that are involved in a particular role. So if you look at ones that require lower levels of formal education, minimal complex interactions with people, and are fairly repetitive. But those types of characteristics are becoming less and less relevant as technology advances. So we're all fairly susceptible to automation in some way or another. What's really important is ensuring that or focusing our efforts or our support on the jobs that are both at high risk of automation and also have lower labor mobility. So they're less able to transition or adapt to a transforming role and might need some additional training or support to be able to effectively continue to contribute to the economy and retain their livelihood.
I remember hearing this story about how lawyers could be replaced by AI because they could churn through, you know, a million pages of legal precedent, in a task that would have taken young associates days and days and days. One of the themes that emerged from your report is something you call rapid growth clean economy. Do you believe this is going to be a real piece of the labor market in the future? Because it's got a lot of buzz, there's a lot of sizzle. Is there steak?
Yeah. So, and you bring up a good point. It does have a lot of international attention right now. What we are really trying to focus on is, you know, where are the high growth potential in the economy? Where are the jobs going to be, where is growth going to come from in different parts of the economy moving forward? We took a shot at the clean economy from the beginning, but we could have easily looked at Canada's oceans economy or Canada's digital economy. The thing that we want to emphasize is getting people from maybe more vulnerable parts of the economy into fast growth occupations and careers. It's really about ensuring that these different individuals are able to adapt to a transforming occupation.
Which is no small task, given the skill set that people have been working with, some for decades, to then pivot, sorry for the cliche word, but pivot to a new thing. You identify something you call foundational and social skills that people will need. What are some examples of those skills?
Yeah, so let's take an example, say a cashier. I'm sure you've seen the self-checkout popping up in yep. all the different stores. You know, cashiers are no longer mainly processing transactions, but, you know, instead they're providing IT support. They're focusing a lot on customer service, you know, helping individuals who, you know, might not be able to, manage the self-checkout themselves. And they're being freed up to help with other potentially higher value tasks throughout the store. So when we're talking about different social and emotional skills, these are things that are really the ones that we have significant difficulty automating. It's the things that really make us human. Being able to, you know, again, thinking back to the having complex interactions with people. Those are things that. So, your job is safe, I think, Bruce, in terms of being on the radio here. So, that's really what we're trying to highlight with those social emotional skills. Is, you know, it's not just computation. It's not just, you know, moving something from point A to point B. It's those that high value stuff that humans are great at.
You talk about some of the structural barriers to making changes like this. One of them, I think the most interesting one, is that the current demand could hamper interest. What does that mean?
Well, I think there's a couple different types of barriers. If you're thinking about transitioning between the occupations themselves, we need to really think about the skills differentials between different occupations and different jobs. We need to look at the wages between the different jobs. There's also, aside from those more tangible factors, there's also different considerations for employees themselves. So maybe there might be fear around transitions. You know, maybe there's potentially negative perceptions of particular types of jobs, say for in the clean example, the clean economy, for example. So it's really trying to understand what are the types of barriers that do exist and, you know, what can we do to help mitigate those?
You've got a number of calls to action, and you think about this through a number of different lenses, the employee, the employer, government. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You point us to something called OpportuneXt. What is that?
Yeah, so that's a tool that we've developed to really help give people a quick view of, you know, what sorts of options are available to them. You know, maybe they have an understanding of where they sit. They want to see, you know, what are the closest types of occupations that they might, you know, potentially transition to, make a career change. Understanding what types of skills are required to make those changes. So it's really giving people a quick view. We're taking a lot of Statistics Canada data, a lot of job postings data, and we're integrating that into a useful tool to just provide more information and help people understand what opportunities are available to them.
From a government standpoint, is enough being done, in your view, to keep us, keep the train on the tracks to lead Canada to this future where people are employed in work that compensates them appropriately and which captures their great gifts?
I mean, I don't know if I can speak to that directly, but I do know that, you know, this is really a wicked problem. It's nothing. It's something that doesn't have, you know, easy answers or easy solutions. There's a lot of different moving parts, and there's a lot of different stakeholders, like you said, governments, employers, educational institutions, and workers themselves that all have, you know, potentially a job to play in ensuring that, you know, Canada's workforce is ready for the future of work. So there are a lot of different, you know, potential policies and programs that governments have available to them to be able to support this transition into the future of work. And I think that what we're trying to do with this research is just, you know, dig away at the problem a little bit and break it down into more digestible pieces that we can then attack different parts of the problem and hopefully, you know, move the needle a little bit forward to that future state.
Interesting stuff, both exciting and terrifying in equal measure. Darren, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bruce.
Darren Gresh, Senior Research Associate of Innovation and Tech at the Conference Board of Canada, joins us today from Ottawa.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
All right, think back for a second here. Think back to when you were a teenager and what was important to you? What did you think about? What did you angst about? I can bet it was not about how you could best share financial responsibilities with your high school sweetheart or how you would navigate financial issues with your high school sweetheart. Teen hormones are focused on other things. Tale as old as time. It was never about money. However, a new study from Junior Achievement and the Allstate Foundation found that one in three teens in the U.S., we can say that the same could be similar here in Canada, have experienced unhealthy financial warning signs in a romantic relationship. Joining us now to talk about this study and how to spot some of the signs for us as parents is Ed Grahalski, Senior Vice President for Brand at Junior Achievement USA. He's in Boulder, Colorado. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me, Bruce.
Why this study? What were you trying to learn? Or was this one of those studies that you fielded only because you know it would make people like me curious?
Well, I mean, there's a very good reason for this study, you know, in terms of relationships where there's a domestic abuse situation, about 96% of them have what would be called financial abuse. Mm. And this is an area that the Allstate Foundation is very concerned about. And that's an adult population statistic. The Allstate Foundation partnered with Junior Achievement on our program called JA Personal Finance 2.0, which was really designed to help educate high school students about, you know, personal finance. But one of the things we wanted to really look into is, are there indicators of these unhealthy financial relationships earlier than adulthood? And what we found is about a third of teens reported experiencing things with their, you know, a partner who's a romantic partner more than friend that would qualify, you know, as financial abuse, which is obviously very disconcerting.
And how would you articulate what you mean when you say financial abuse?
So a lot of it has to do with control over money. So not letting a person spend their money on what they want to, not letting them go to work, basically running up debt, which obviously would be outside of the teenagers. But so it's kind of a control issue where one partner ends up basically being victimized by the behaviors of the other partner.
Did this surprise you?
You know, it's interesting. I think maybe it surprised me from the standpoint that you have teens that are this honest and forthcoming, because this percentage actually is pretty similar to what's happening in adult population in terms of total population. So I felt like the team's very honest in sharing their thoughts about this. So again, if there is a surprise, it was that.
You know why it surprised me? I only have an 11-year-old. Like, it's a different, it's a tween demographic versus a teen. But I was surprised that there would be enough material for these problematic circumstances to arise, right? Like, it makes tons of sense when you're a grown-up and you've got a job and your partner has a job and all that. There's lots of ways in which control and conflict and abuse, as you say, could manifest. It just surprises me that that could happen when you'd think their concerns are TikTok, Snapchat, and whether they're going to have a Monster energy drink before they write their exam.
Right. Well, and again, I mean, with kids are getting access to money through allowances and you know, even jobs. And so you hear things like a third of the teens saying that they've loaned money to their partner and it wasn't paid back. I mean, so it when you start putting in those terms, it starts to, you start to see, okay, now I see where this is coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if the amounts are small, if you just then extend that, you know, 5 years into the future, 10 years into the future, right, if the behavior stays the same, the consequence becomes ever the more dramatic.
Yes, absolutely.
More than half of the teens surveyed trust their parents or guardians the most to talk about healthy shared finances. That's encouraging. Is that encouraging?
It's encouraging. 61% said that they do trust their parents, but only about 30% have actually talked to their parents about these situations. Mm-hmm. The other thing that was interesting in the data that came up is that 55% of teens said that they've heard their parents over the past 30 days argue about money. Now, that obviously can vary from just an incidental expense versus something that might be more disconcerting. But again, even though they trust their parents, they're not necessarily going to them to have these conversations in a lot of cases.
One of the things we know about financial literacy in schools is that you can teach, you know, the ins and outs, you can teach the math, but where kids learn so much is in the home and the behavior that is modeled by their parents, both in spending habits, but also in conversation. So that stat on seeing parents argue, that one's almost even more concerning to me.
Yeah. And there's another part of it where about 33% said that their parents have spent money on things that weren't necessities at a time when the family needed something. So it does, that there could be some behavior modeling happening in that respect. So that's certainly something for concern. Yeah.
Not that we don't have teenage listeners. Hello, everyone under the age of, 21. But I think that by and large, the listeners of this show are adults and they may well be adults with kids. What would be the takeaway that you would offer for parents as we hear that context and think, whoa, what am I going to do to make sure that I'm on top of this to mitigate the risks for my teens?
Well, I think what's really important, and again, you see most teens, trust their parents, they have these conversations, but they're not doing it. And so there might be kind of a, parents may want to be proactive and start those conversations with them, just to make sure that there isn't something going on that they're not talking about. There's also some other resources. If you go to the allstatefoundation.org, they have a lot of resources out there that really help parents start these conversations and kind of how you walk through those steps with your kids.
Tell me more about Allstate Foundation and the JA relationship. How did that begin? What's the intersection? What are you two trying to do together?
So the Allstate Foundation has actually worked with Junior Achievement for many years, but this is a new iteration of that relationship because we are specifically addressing this issue that certainly has been a priority for the foundation for quite a while. And really what we want to do is help kids see the signs or teenagers see the signs of unhealthy financial relationship. So our JA Personal Finance 2.0 really gets into it. We talk about how credit works, how debt works, how you can kind of be saddled by joint debt, what a credit score is and why you want to make sure that you're protecting that credit score as much as possible. But really, it really helps them understand that, okay, the behavior that you're seeing here, you're loaning money and you're not getting it back, or someone's telling you what you can and can't buy, that's not okay. And that's something that is actually fairly new to us in terms of the way we, deliver our lessons. So I think it's a really important thing that we're able to share with young people.
The cliche phrase is keeping up with the Joneses. That is something that everyone on this planet has to navigate in some way, call it FOMO, call it in a high school context, peer pressure, an age in one's life in which one is less able to resist those forces. What additional perspective might you offer on how that works into the pressures that teens face and that they would face in relationships? Because I can imagine practically, you know, it's like, let's go out. There's a big party happening and it's going to be $100 for us to go do that. We have to go do that. And there would be almost a gap in maturity, perhaps, for a teen to navigate that versus a 25-year-old.
Well, one of the things that we found in terms of our programming is that it really does a good job of helping to promote self-confidence and self-belief. And I think that's a really important thing to have when you're looking at keeping up with the Joneses. You know, there's a saying that comparison is the thief of joy. And that's obviously a big issue in high school. And what we're really trying to do is help kids have a little bit clear self-concept of who they are and what they want to be and what they want to do. And I think that's one way to really help address this, because otherwise it can be incredibly challenging. High school's tough anyway. And then you would have a dynamic like this where someone's kind of controlling a relationship and using money as part of it. It would be very problematic. I can really see that.
Comparison is the thief of joy. Woo! I think that's a great place to finish. Ed, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Ed Grahalski is Senior Vice President of Brand for Junior Achievement USA. He was here to talk about a new study from JA and the Allstate Foundation that looks at the relationship dynamic for young people and the warning signs in the area of money that might lead to real concerns about relationships over time. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, we're going to talk more about this relationship dynamic, but from a bit of a different angle. We're going to talk to Christine Beese. She is the founder of Untangle Money, which is a service to help women overcome some of the barriers that they face that males simply do not. And later, investing in private equity, Stack Capital CEO Jeff Parks will be here. He's got a whole democratizing money thing, and we'll see how that works. If you would like to tune into past episodes of the show, please head over to the website. It is moolala.ca. You can search by name, a guest name, by topic. You can listen to all the episodes you want. They're all there.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. We talk a lot about the gender dynamic in personal finance, and we talk about it a lot because it is real, it is relevant, and I would say it is reducible. Is that the best word? No, there's stuff you can do about it. There's stuff you can do about it. And one of the things you can do about it, and we can do about it on this show, is to bring the spotlight to those individuals who are really endeavoring to make a difference, to even the playing field, to create opportunity for women to participate in the same way as men. And today our focus falls on platform, website, service called Untangle Money. Christine Beese joins us now to talk about that. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me on the show.
What is Untangle Money?
Yes, well, Untangle Money is a great place to start to learn and understand about your money and your financial future. and it is focused on women. And so all of our assumptions are based on the realities of being a female and having a female financial experience, which is actually quite different than a male financial experience.
Your background academically is engineering physics. You spent the early part of your career working in the energy sector, and then you covered the energy sector as an analyst. It is not empirically a sector that skews female. Fair to say? What did that teach you that relates to Untangle Money, having spent so many of your formative years in that context?
Yeah, you know, I really got a firsthand seat to how being female could affect your finances. And I would argue for me, that came in and around my having children, but for other women, it may come earlier. And so I really saw the impact of that. And I would argue even we see that today. Robin Doolittle did some great work at the Globe and Mail uncovering the gender dynamics in pay in the law profession. So even in these sort of spaces where we believe that either the gender gap doesn't exist, or, you know, at least women went into careers that are supposed to be higher paying, we are still seeing a pay gap. But I would argue the more nefarious result of the pay gap is actually the wealth gap. So I crunched the numbers. Robin Doolittle said it's roughly $350,000 that women are making less the female partners than their male counterparts. And if that gap only exists for 10 years and you were to invest that money at 4.5%, that's $4.7 million, which is a lot of financial choices that you could be making.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the horrifying manifestation of compound returns. You know, yeah. The great one is I saved $100 a month at 4.5%. That's so great. Well, right. You know, when the pay gap is that dramatic for those many years and yes. On such a high absolute number, the gap is quite dramatic.
Yes.
You mentioned that it was about having kids for you. Tell me more about that. Was it that you made choices to be with your family, to be a parent, that took you out of the traditional business world in which you were, based on your LinkedIn profile, excelling at?
Yes. You know, actually, I never took a full mat leave. I didn't do that because I was not focused on my family or overly focused on my career. I just, that was just the choice I made for myself at the time. I thought it was a good balance, but it was clear when I returned to the workforce, I was put on a different portfolio. My background was in oil and gas. I was then put into a different sector. And I just felt that all the gains and everything I'd worked for, suddenly they no longer played to my advantage. And I was suddenly at a disadvantage. So my career was really impacted. And thus my ability to make money was very impacted. And I don't think I realized that was going to be the case ever. I came out of engineering. I came out at a time where I think we thought the, you know, gender equality was behind us. And, you know, here I sit 44 and I think it's almost worse than ever in some ways. Again, especially when it comes to the wealth gap. For every dollar a man has in wealth, a woman has 32 cents on average. And it's gone in the wrong direction. 10 years ago, women had 36 cents in wealth. So that's
the data is astounding. We've hammered it and hammered it and hammered it and hammered it. And I'm sure it's made absolutely no difference. But here's what I think would be really relevant and helpful to our listeners. If you had a do-over, if you had a do-over in those times and could snap your finger and get the leadership of the firms that you worked for, and it wasn't just one, I'm sure, because it's not, these things can happen over time.
Yes.
What would you want? What would have kept you on that? I mean, I don't think
career.
In that mode of like just crunching it out. I look at your trajectory and listen, you could have made the choice to be an entrepreneur and done different things, or you could have made the choice to be a full-time mom. And all of these choices are amazing and fantastic.
Yeah.
It's just from your earlier story, it sounds like there's something that had you say, you know what? No, I'm getting off that crazy train.
Yeah. And do you know what? This is so applicable to today and what we're seeing with the return to work, because I had my first children in England, and at the time you could write a request for augmented work on the return. And there was already a case where there was a mother already in the room. She was in equity research and she was working from home one day a week. And so I applied and, you know, all my friends not in the finance industry were getting these accommodations. And all I needed was one day to work from home. And really it was about the laundry. And I know it sounds so trivial, but
oh, I know from the laundry.
So many loads of laundry and just an opportunity not to have to get all gussied up, not to have to do the commute into work and come out again. And just about that was the best way that I could figure out to fit it all in. And it was declined. And so I did it for a few months and realized that I was failing both at the role that I wanted to play as a mom and the role I wanted to play in my career. And now as we're looking, the reason I bring it, say it's poignant now is we're looking at this great return to work and we've seen how flexible the working from home can be. And my fear is that that is just going to be a race and we're going to forget about it. And that is going to disadvantage women. And I know the argument of FaceTime and being present, it's also important. You can't completely disappear, but I hope that we land on this balance where there will be some more accommodation and flexibility and it's for trivial things like laundry, but it just has to get done at some point in time.
Yeah.
And I can't be in two places at once. So
I don't think it's trivial. So I am in a two dad household. We have just the same amount of laundry. The difference that I have as a dude is I don't have to put up with any of those other things.
Right.
There is a level of privilege, despite the fact that I'm the primary laundry doer around here. I'm a dude, I'm a male. And that is, it's one of the things that is infuriating from my standpoint about that, the level of privilege that I get for no reason. Now I do want to bring it back to Untangle Money. I love that. Sure. I appreciate your disclosure and how this is so real and relevant for you is you have a number of plans in which people can, you know, pay your company to help plan money and all that stuff. Who's your target market? Who do you want to partake in the offers that you have?
Yeah. So we have a target for individuals and we have a target for companies. We do teach webinars that companies can give to their employees. But when it comes to individuals, we are really targeting people who would be relying on bank branch services. We are looking at specifically women or people who do not feel comfortable in the current service offering that is being provided. And we're looking for people who make less than $150,000 a year.
Yeah, which is most Canadians. Most Canadians. Maybe not the people who you went to engineering physics school with, but most Canadians. And how would these services differ from what one would receive at a branch or what one would receive at a fee-based financial planner or what one would receive at Credit Canada as a, you know, our agency is a nonprofit credit counselor?
Yes, I love that agency. Well, Untangle Money, we really create tools to help you understand your money. And we differ from financial planners in three main ways. We're independent, so we don't sell you anything other than the product you purchase. So you know that what we're telling you is unbiased, and we're not telling you it so that you'll buy another product. Secondly, I think we discuss risk differently. Most of the industry is focused on the risks that you're taking now by including stocks in your portfolio, the risk of balancing that portfolio properly. We really want to make sure that you're balancing out those risks with the risks of underfunding your retirement, because we know that in Canada, the longer you live in retirement as a female, the more likely you are to enter poverty. So we really want to reframe that and say, might be worth taking a little bit more risk now and mitigating that risk in the future. And lastly, we do not judge how you spend your money, how you save your money, or how you invest your money. So while we are focused on retirement, because we think that women need to focus on it earlier than men, because there is a greater risk of us not achieving our retirement goal. If you, Bruce, say you want to YOLO your life and spend every penny, we will support you on that. And we will teach you about something that we've coined the Golden Girls Retirement Movement. All we want to do is to ensure that you understand the future you're choosing with your current lifestyle and make sure you're okay with that. And if not, that you have the time to, and you understand the trade-offs and changes you need to make to change that future. But if you like that outcome, we will not judge you
just
for it.
Just go for it.
You go
Christine,
for it.
Go for it. Money. It's your money. It's your money, your future. And there is certainly a huge amount that is within one's circle of control, even though a bunch of these macro dynamics are need to be solved in other ways. Individuals 100%. Do have a certain amount of control. Christine, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce. It was wonderful.
Christine Beese is the founder of Untangle Money. Check it out. Untangle Money.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, we'll talk to Jeff Parks, CEO of Stack Capital, about investing in private equity. He's kind of going down the, you know, buy a fractional jet ownership plan, making private equity, which is typically a pretty big dollar ring, available to mere mortals like you and me. But first, Momentum's Youth Fair Gains program with Carolyn Davis. And listen, if you want to find out more about the content that we are producing on this show, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, on BNM Bloomberg, you wouldn't believe how much I could talk. A lot, like a lot. Sign up for our newsletter. Go to moolala.ca. You can sign up there. It's free. Comes once a month. And I am never going to do anything with your email address other than send you a newsletter.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If we could only get them early, if we could teach young people about money early, think about that. We teach them early, then they've got decades and decades and decades doing just a few more of the things that will help them get and keep a handle on their money. But that's not easy. Easier said than done. Our next guest has this really great idea that you're going to want to hear more about. Carolyn Davis is Director of Community Engagement at Momentum, and it offers something called the Youth Fair Gains Program. Part education, part a matched savings component, which is genius. Carolyn joins us from Calgary. Hello there.
Hi.
What is the Youth Fair Gains Program?
So at Momentum's Youth Fair Gains program, youth earn a match to their own savings while they are learning about money.
Ooh, are you just going to roll with that? Earn and learn? It's like
we're going to roll with earn and learn.
Earn and learn. Okay. So how do they earn the money? What do they have to do?
Yeah. So young people join us. They agree to come to class twice a month. Usually that's in person. In the pandemic, we do that online. They build a community of people outside of their school group. And we have fabulous facilitators that help make the fundamentals of money management accessible to a younger audience. So in exchange at first for them agreeing to come and learn these skills, we set aside money for every dollar they save. And so an individual young person might put aside $50 a month. We match that money 4-to-1. And then at the end of the program, 9 months of program, they have the opportunity to cash that money out for a lasting asset that's going to move their life forward.
What's an example of a lasting asset, and does a phone qualify? Because I think if I were a teen, that would be one of the things on my list.
For sure. So the lasting asset that most young people choose, 97 or higher percent, they use it to invest in their post-secondary education. But to go to school, sometimes you need other things, right? Like you need books, and maybe you do need that laptop or the phone. And so those are all sort of part of the package of things that can be cashed out for. Young people would usually keep the matching money from Momentum for the big ticket items like their tuition.
very smart, better teens than I would have been. Actually, that's not true. I would have done the same thing. What would you say by way of context that is different for young people from lower income families versus from higher income families, and not just the dollars, but the culture, the circumstances that they wake up into every day?
Well, many young people from higher income families, they get, for starters, they get help financially from parents or grandparents to pay for school. That's just a lot harder. In a lower income family, there's not as much money to go around, and the daily needs usually dominate, and that's kind of reasonable. So youth fair gains in some ways contributes to improving equitable access to post-secondary education. The other thing is that young people from lower income households probably aren't learning as much about money from their parents, or what they are learning is very specific to a scarcity and resourcefulness mindset, which can be useful. But this program, I see it as inviting young people to learn from a broader set of mentors that have maybe have different perspectives about money, and really setting them up to make sure that as they enter this world where there's credit and banking options and like just so many decisions to make, that they've got a really solid foundation to be able to make those decisions from.
It's so interesting to see, just as a specific example, expectations around post-secondary education. If you're the fifth generation of kid that has had a family history of people going to university for 50 years, you just feel like you have to go. If you don't go, it's a big, big deal. If you weren't raised breathing that air, it's a much bigger deal for you to, you know, crunch the school and save the money and even dream about going to post-secondary education.
Absolutely. And we know, the data shows, that post-secondary education is a very reliable way for someone to increase their lifetime earning potential. And so we really want to be tearing down barriers to accessing that education.
What are some other examples of the things that students learn?
So our five kind of primary areas of learning are assets, which is not all about the financials, but it does include them. Credit, which many young people will tell us is the most important one for them. Banking, budgeting, and consumerism. And that's a really interesting conversation to be having with youth right now, because a lot of the ways that they're accessing media, like social media platforms, they're inherently commercialized. And so it's really interesting to have conversations with that audience about how do you navigate that world where that's the way you connect with your friends, but also how do you understand what's really going on there so that you can be savvy?
And how do you have that conversation? Because I say time and again how I am living life with a tween in my house and seeing the expectations of what she believes she's entitled to as a citizen of this planet is in stark contrast to what I ever thought I was entitled to or would even have deserved at that age.
You're right. The world has changed a lot. And people who are coming from lower income backgrounds may have a slightly different perspective on what is a need and what is a want. And yet they are still learning to navigate the same world that all of us are trying to navigate. And I'm hopeful that opening up a safe space to have conversations about money, about needs and wants, and what's that ad trying to tell me? And is there a way for me to meet that need in a different way? Is a start of a positive conversation.
Momentum is based in Alberta. It's, you know, got some experience and some cred on offering this program. In a virtual world, you're doing this with virtual attendees. If you could snap your fingers and rope in listeners that tune into this show in financial services or in the not-for-profit space, what would take this program to an order of magnitude of 10?
So far, we've had the opportunity to work with about 600 graduates. Our research tells us 97% of them keep saving regularly after the program ends. If I were snapping my fingers, I just want everyone with leverage in this space to know that our community will be so much stronger if we have a whole city of savers. If everybody on our block had at least a $500 emergency fund, just think about what might be possible for us as a whole community if those that basic stress about money were alleviated. That's really where we want to go.
A city of savers. Love it and love that it's time for young people to learn and earn. Carolyn, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Bruce.
You're welcome. The program is called the Youth Fair Gains Program. You can learn more about it at momentum.org. Stay with us. Coming up next, Jeff Parks will be here to talk about Stack Capital and its method for allowing the great unwashed to invest in private equity. That's me. I'm included in that. Listen for more Moolala content or insight, or I don't know what you call it. Tune into CityLine. It is a daily lifestyle show on the air across North America. And if you don't catch it live, you can go to cityline.tv and all the segments are on there, money and otherwise.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We talk a lot about this idea of democratizing money, and there are, you know, still so many. Most products and services have a thing that is available only to the rich, but there are many things that have become accessible to the masses over time. You know, you didn't have a financial advisor, you could get a robo-advisor. You couldn't buy a Picasso yourself, you can buy a piece of a Picasso instead of a Picasso mutual fund. You can have private jets on fractional ownership. That one might be a bit of a stretch, but still, investing in private equity has not been accessible to most people, given that the minimums, they can be in the millions and millions of dollars. Stack Capital says it is trying to change that, giving a chance for more people to invest in companies and in a way that is usually saved for institutions, for pensions funds, for pension funds, for high net worth individuals. So we're going to take a look at that. Jeff Parks is the CEO of Stack Capital. He joins us now to talk about it. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
How does your model work?
So our model is different. So we're a publicly traded company. So anybody who has a brokerage account, a retail broker, however they access stocks in the public market, are able to buy our shares on the actual exchange. And through those shares, you'll then have access to 10 to 15 different high-profile late-stage companies. Now, we did just raise the money in the last 3 months, and we have one company in there right now, and we're looking to add more companies to get up to that 10 to 15 target.
Can you give me an example or two of the companies that would be of interest to you?
Yeah, like so I can talk to you about the one that we actually just put in the portfolio the other day, Varo Bank. It's a fintech company, $2.5 billion company run by an ex-executive of American Express and Lloyds of London. And it's a fintech company giving access to Americans. There's over 180 million battlers and builders who don't have proper bank accounts because the regular incumbent banks don't serve them. And this is an all-digital bank that is the only fintech in the U.S. that has a U.S. banking license. So something very different than a lot of the other fintechs out there.
Why this model? Surely it would have been easier to, you know, have lunches with fancy friends and get them to sign on to a traditional private equity fund. Going to the consumer, that just seems like a lot more work.
I would say it's a more interesting model because you're right. We could have just gone out there and raised a regular fund, but we're trying to democratize access for people. We're trying to get the individuals who aren't accredited investors or don't have the access because they don't have the relationships to get into these individual names and give access to everybody. And that's what's so beautiful about this model is that anybody can go buy those shares on the exchange and get access into these incredible, incredible businesses.
What should investors know about risk? And I ask because if you're buying a mutual fund filled with big old boring global, large cap companies, it's a different risk profile than if you're buying a mutual fund that has small cap companies. This is even smaller because the underlying investments aren't publicly traded themselves. So what would you say to prospective investors about the risk they need to be able to endure?
So I would say what we want are shareholders who are long-term oriented individuals. And the risk that we would be taking is if you look at a J curve, we're not going after the early stage in the pre-seed companies. We're going after the later stage in the larger growth stage companies that are very close to IPOing. So they're big businesses. They have proven product market fit. A lot of them have cashed up balance sheets and a lot of revenues as well. So we're trying to reduce the risk because we're trying to invest in these companies 6 to 36 months away from them going public. So reducing a lot of that risk being at the end of the J curve.
Why do you use the phrase private equity then instead of venture capital? And I ask because when I think of private equity, I think of, you know, they could be really old legacy companies doing really boring things. They're just not publicly traded. Whereas the kinds of businesses that you're talking about would be ones where the founders are walking the halls of the fancy offices in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so we're kind of at that crossroad between, you're exactly right. We're not a venture capital because when you talk about venture capital companies, you generally think, okay, these guys are the early stage. They're getting in there on the Series A or the pre-seed. And then private equity, to your point, old, boring industrial businesses. So we're kind of a mix between the two where a lot of the companies that we go after, they're probably tech-oriented, disruptor, high margin profile, newer age businesses. So we kind of sit right in the middle of both of those businesses, the private equity and the venture capital.
You mentioned that you want folks who are able to play the long-term game, and yet you're a publicly traded stock. I looked at your curve since you went public, and I'm sure you'd like the curve to be a little different than it is. How do you deal with the short-term nature of the stock market? Just inherently, it's shorter term than private equity.
It definitely is shorter term, and you will see those individuals who get tired quicker and want to cycle out. And those long-term core shareholders from the pensions or the hedge funds or the retail investor who want to ride that path. So I think as we get more businesses within our portfolio and investors don't just realize that it's just cash, it's actual investments, and we have the access that we said on our IPO roadshow, that more and more people will actually gravitate towards our stock and bring it in line with that book value per share and actual trading price.
Investors in good old mutual funds or even exchange traded funds are pretty familiar with a management expense ratio. Like that's kind of how they can think about fees. And for a Canadian large cap equity fund, it would be somewhere around, call it 2%. Private equity is typically 2 and 20. As I understand it, 2% fee, 20% of the profits. How do the fees work for Stack?
Yeah, so Stack. So we have an external manager, and that external manager, like you said, we make 1.5 and 15. So we're above the mutual fund because we're giving access into an asset class that is very, very hard to get access into, but we're below the hedge funds where they're locking up your money for a significant period of time. So we're right in the middle of those two.
How big do you predict? So this isn't like fantasy land of unicorns and butterflies, but how big do you predict your pool of investable capital will be in 5 years?
We think in 5 years, we can get to around 500 million to a billion in AUM in this strategy, just because the names that you can get access to, and when the street realizes the names that we're able to put in the portfolio, we think a lot of people will gravitate, plus the organic growth of those underlying positions. You're able to make a significant multiple on those underlying positions after we put them in the portfolio.
How do you assess the names that you would be super interested in? Are the metrics different? How important is management? Like, how do you think through these investments in a way that might be similar to or different from how an investor running even a small cap fund would be thinking?
I would say it's very, very similar. So you're looking at different metrics, from price to sales, to looking at what the gross margin profile would be on a steady state business. You're looking at those growth profiles. You're really looking at the management team and saying, have they done this before? Can they do this again? Who are these individuals? So I wouldn't say one size fits all for each individual company. And the best thing about us is we're generalists, and we always have been generalists. So there's a multitude of different industries and companies that we can actually look at and assess from our past careers.
As generalists, the pro is diversification. The con is valuation. Like it becomes very difficult for you to think, wait a sec, here's kind of what I think about growth rates for SaaS or growth rates for fintech. How do you blend the growth rate such that it kind of makes sense? Or are you just saying, throw out the box, recycle the box, we will not be put in a box?
Yeah, we definitely won't be put in the box. And you'll sit there, and to your point, there's different growth rates for different industries. A lot of them, though, in the technological disruptive businesses, they have similar profiles. So you can kind of utilize that over and over again. And what really helps out is actually seeing what's going on in the public market and then applying that over into the private market and looking, what are those comps going to look like in the public market versus where are we buying these in the private market, and try to capture that valuation disconnect for that illiquidity.
Interesting stuff. Jeff, thanks for your time today.
Really appreciate it, Bruce. Thank you very much.
Jeff Parks is CEO of Stack Capital. We were talking about its private equity model, which is now publicly traded, a new way for regular folks to get into that game. Well, that is our show for today. Thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, this country's first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, very simple to do that. There is a newsletter you can sign up for at moolala.ca. You can also sign up to or subscribe to this podcast, wherever you got it in the first place. If you have comments, questions, feedback, thoughts for our eyes, ask@moolala.ca is our email address. I don't know why I hesitated there. ask@moolala.ca. Please send us your thoughts or questions. On social media, I'm at Bruce Sellery on Twitter. That's spelled S-E-L-L-E-R-Y. Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for joining us, and have a great day.